My name is William, and you're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
Desperate voters in 2024, Trump was a wild card. He promised voters that he would be, in his words, their retribution. He named the enemy. He told voters what he was going to do to the enemy. He was the agent of revenge. The important emotion here is resentment. Resentment, of course, oozes from every pore of class society, and it isn't always appropriately directed. You know, workers often find it easier to hate middle-class professionals or cultural elites whom they do see than the billionaires whom they don't see.
That's Richard Seymour, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Seymour on resentment politics. There's a class in this country that reeks of obscene wealth. From mansions in Beverly Hills and the Hamptons, they fly around in their private jets and sail the seas in their luxury yachts. Left behind are countless millions who are subjected to austerity programs and lectures about hard work. The rise, not just in the United States, but globally, of right-wing politics is fueled by economic inequality. Joseph Goebbels was Hitler's minister of propaganda. He always insisted that it was a mistake to rely on logic and facts to manipulate people. The skilled propagandist, he said, must focus on emotions, not reason. Everything must be depicted in simple terms and constantly repeated. Resentment is a powerful force. We see it in today's politics. Our guest today is Richard Seymour. He's a writer, broadcaster, and author of numerous books, including Disaster Nationalism. His articles appear in the New York Times, London Review of Books, The Guardian, and Jacobin. He spoke at the Socialism 2025 conference in Chicago in July. And now, Richard Seymour on resentment politics.
So I want to start with Trump. Trump's expanded his electoral base in every election since 2016. In 2024, he gained among working class voters, or rather those who actually bothered to turn out. In each election, he also gained among non-white voters, and it's worth noting his share of the white vote remains roughly below that achieved by Mitt Romney in 2012. Now, there's nothing shocking in Trump's ascendancy. It's been the pattern in India, the Philippines, Hungary, Brazil. It's the pattern in France, where Le Pen's share of the presidential vote climbs in each outing. It's the pattern in Germany, where the AfD is now the second largest party. And now in the UK, where Reform could possibly win the next general election. Certainly, when you look at the polls, inflation preoccupied your 2024 voters. But if you look more closely, Trump's policies, after all, are inflationary. And this was obvious. Mass deportations and tariffs were always going to raise prices. How trustworthy is polling on economic sentiment in the US when it's so partisan? For example, Republicans claim to be very badly affected by inflation. Democratic voters claim to be hardly affected at all. Another question, why did inflation matter in 2024 when it had stabilized to 2.4% and not in 2022 when it was around 9%? And part of the answer there is that in 2022, voters didn't blame either party for inflation. So what drove inflation up the agenda? The Democrats, as you probably know, shed something like between 6 million votes between 2020 and 2024. That was over twice the number of votes that Trump gained. And the biggest reason defectors gave for not voting Democrat in 2024 was Gaza, with the economy coming second. The mobilizations that had built to 2020 election in which Trump was defeated, including, of course, Black Lives Matter, but also, I think, probably the Sanders insurgencies, unionization drives, and so on, were, by 2024, largely trashed and forgotten. Green investment brutally pared back. Biden set new records in oil extraction. Biden and Harris escalated deportations. They expanded ICE, and they devised a far-right borders bill. And the main social movement of the time, unlike Black Lives Matter in 2020, against the Gaza genocide, which was supported by the Biden administration, was excluded, denounced, slandered, subject to legal repression and targeted vigilante and lone wolf violence. I want to be clear about that. Of course, Black Lives Matter was subject to a lot of those things as well, but it also had a lot of mainstream support. For some desperate voters in 2024, Trump was a wild card. Some thought that his tariffs might achieve what Biden's reform had not. Some believed that his version of rail politic would be less onerous for the Palestinians than Biden's fanatical Zionism. But mostly, he promised voters that he would be, in his words, their retribution. He named the enemy. He told voters what he was going to do to the enemy. He was the agent of revenge. So what I'm saying here is we can talk about the economics, we can talk about inflation, but there is no economic experience that translates immediately into a political behavior. It always passes through the interval of emotion and ideology. No political economy without libidinal economy. And just to be clear, because somebody's going to stand up and say, oh, Richard's reducing everything to psychology. No, it's two things at once. The important emotion here is resentment. Resentment, of course, oozes from every pore of class society, and it isn't always appropriately directed. You know, workers often find it easier to hate middle-class professionals or cultural elites whom they do see than the billionaires whom they don't see. They often hate those they perceive as competitors or spongers or interlopers rather than their exploiters. Resentment, however, is a moral emotion. We can't do without it. So I'm not just here to bash resentment as bad politics. But the problem is we can sicken on it if we don't move beyond resentment. As one wag famously said, resentment's like swallowing poison and waiting for the other fellow to die. So I want you to think then about the chronic disasters in our lives. Think about war, recession, pandemic, supply shock, inflation, genocide. And think about our political paralysis, our felt lack of agency or efficacy. Think about the ways in which that may have charged people up with resentment, our ability to take care of things that past generations could take care of. It's all slowly being removed from us. Basic competences are being black boxed in order to be sold back to us. We're being schooled in helplessness, and then they sell us self-help, often enough macho self-help. It's a really contradictory situation because we've never been more educated in the aggregate, and information has never been so abundant. But information isn't the same thing as the truth. It's often pure somatic force, a provocation, a gut punch to make you do something or buy something or subscribe to something or to commit a lone wolf massacre. Now, let me tell you about one disaster so you can see where I'm coming from with all this. Recall back in the summer of 2020, the state of Oregon, wildfire bigger than anything in living memory in that state so far. In the Pacific Northwest, tons of organic fuels dry out every summer. Hot, dry winds blow in from the east, and a spark can trigger a blaze that cuts through the forests with brush with teeth of flame tens of meters long. The intensity of those blazes has been increasing over the last three decades as the climate has warmed. September 2020, the wildfire swept over the Cascade Mountain Range in the west of Oregon, was driven up the slopes, which were blanketed with fuel-rich pine forests, and was oxygenated and pushed over the Cordillera Chines by hurricane-strength Pacific winds until it rolled across the rural plains and forests like lava. Winds blew wildfires into megafires and down power lines to create more fires, burning it up to 800 degrees Celsius. 10% of the state's population was forced to evacuate. Thousands of homes were destroyed. 33 people actually killed. So we often hear that disasters bring people together. We hear about the city of comrades, the democracy of distress, or what Rebecca Solnit calls disaster communities. It ain't necessarily so. Kai Erickson, a disaster specialist, found not a single example of this in all his years of work. And if it happens, it happens only where the community wasn't already riven with ethnic and class fault lines. Erickson found that in most scenarios, acute disaster compounds chronic disaster. People shut down. They feel, in his words, a psychological concussion. They retreat into the survivalist peripheries of life. And yet, today's far right loves disaster. They can't stop fantasizing about imaginary disasters, great replacement, white genocide, FEMA death camps. They love raging and rioting and pogroming against imaginary disaster. And in Oregon, this took the form of a spontaneous mass apocalyptic fantasy spread through social industry networks because there's scant local news, and then echoed by figures in authority from local police to Donald Trump, that Antifa set the fires to massacre white conservative Christians, to impose a liberal tyranny. Look at Black Lives Matter. There's the seditious plot. Look at the COVID health lockdown. There's the liberal tyranny. They're coming for us. Who's coming? The Democrats. These terrorists are paid mercenaries of the Democrats. Vigilantes set up armed checkpoints and people refuse to evacuate. A man told to flee for his life says, I'm protecting my city. If I see people doing crap, I'm going to hurt them. So this isn't psychological concussion, but an exciting alternative to that. It's the relief and excitement of being or feeling threatened. Relief because it allows something that was already there to enter consciousness. Excitement because, well, you can hit back. You can't shoot capitalism or climate change. You can't. You can shoot Antifa. You can shoot Black Lives Matter. And you can march on the Capitol and try to string up the communists who you say are in charge. Very exciting. It solves nothing because, like any symptom, it exists to avoid the solution. But it is addictive, that cycle of threat and release. And the red pill is a far better antidepressant than your CBT or your happy pills. It says those demons in your head are real and you can kill them. And this is what we consistently find with the rise of what I'm calling disaster nationalism. In India, Brazil, the Philippines, the United States, Hungary, Israel, Argentina, Italy, probably France and Germany next. Neonate fascism thrives on and gives a fantastical meaning to the accumulation of small disasters in people's lives, especially as they are crowned by major disasters. It gives them something to take arms against. Whence this pathology? I think we could all imagine we'd start with neoliberal capitalism. I think the idea of a capitalist society is a contradiction in terms, and neoliberalism makes it 10 times worse. It says everyone is a risk-taking entrepreneur, a competitor. There is no public interest. Any war on poverty is a hypocritical lie for self-interested bureaucrats and their clients. Its slogan could be, they're all out to get you. It's a paranoid system, and it's a system designed to steepen the slope of inequality while at the same time inculcating a social Darwinism that means we kiss the arses of the winners and kick the losers. So failure, which is often the name people give to the systemic crises that afflict them, becomes far more toxic and terrifying. Now then, think about the major punctuating crises of the last few decades. Think about the war on terror with its mass bombings, torture, kidnappings, Islamophobic repression, mass surveillance, and the ethno-nationalist alliances from Modi to Sharon. The credit crunch, then austerity, and the monstering of the undeserving poor and migrants and minorities. Think about, in the UK alone, there were 300,000 excess deaths caused by austerity policies. And the ways in which this massive grief and loss would have been politicized subtly as the dominant institutions moved to the racist right. Think of the mainstreaming of far-right parties. Think of the welcome extended to Narendra Modi from the White House and Downing Street when he became Prime Minister of India in 2014, his pogrom long forgotten, and the Gujarat model of development applauded. Think of the institutional aggression against the left and the unions, all designed to ensure that no radical alternative could emerge and actually exert power. So again, we can talk about the economy, but economic experience is shaped by politics and ideology, and often what people do is act against their material interests for a symbolic win. Don't believe for a second that people rioting or killing for the far right are just expressing a misplaced concern about jobs or wages. They want revenge for everything they think has gone wrong. They tell us, the news, that it's a problem with disinformation. But you have to ask yourself, why do people believe the disinformation? Because it answers a deeply felt need. It orchestrates underground currents of resentment into a strategy of revenge. They sometimes tell us that it's a problem of privilege and entitlement. There's an element of truth in that, but that language is often a racist or masculinist solution to a much more deeply felt lack of agency and efficacy. In other words, if you look at the people who express this language, you've never seen a bigger bunch of f-ups in your life, and they're utterly paralyzed just like the rest of us. A situation that the political center seems to encourage. They want you to stay at home and shut up. They say, oh, there's a problem, there's too many migrants, but you stay home and let us deal with it. The far right says, there's the enemy, get out on the streets. And this is partly why collective violence is not an electoral disadvantage for this new far right. It is a unique selling point, and it synergizes with statist violence. We saw this in Gujarat in 2002. We saw it in the USA in 2020 when Republicans were electrified by grassroots violence against Black Lives Matter. And in Brazil in 2022 when Bolsonaro's supporters attacked and murdered Workers' Party supporters, propelling him from being 20 points behind his rival, Lula, to a fraction of a percent of winning. And in the Philippines, where Rodrigo Duterte's approval ratings rarely dip below 90%, and most of his supporters backed his anti-drugs death squads, despite telling pollsters that they feared that they or someone they knew might be killed. We're beyond enlightened self-interest. We're even beyond utopia, actually. Today's far right, unlike interwar fascism, has no utopian horizon. It doesn't even pretend to be anti-capitalist. In India, Hungary, Brazil, Israel, France, and the United States, it has internalized the predicates of neoliberalism. It benefits even from a curious symbiosis with the neoliberal center, in as much as it overlaps in the commitment to social Darwinism, its hostility to democracy, and their tendency to racialize social questions, and of course their interest in cultivating both hopelessness and vengeful passions, what I sometimes call pseudo-pessimism. Today's incipient fascism wants capitalism with the gloves off, capitalism without the woke constraints, but with some national protections. Muscular national capitalism achieved through cleansing violence. And I would say that if you look at this, the tipping point historically and in recent examples is the dialectic of mutual radicalization. This is a situation where the armed base, egged on by the leadership, engages in shock attacks on the enemy. It goes further than the state legally can. But the elected leadership then defends the armed base and supplements it with official violence. It ups the rhetorical ante and it encourages the base to go further. With Trump in power, we see the MAGA dispensation rolled out with stunning velocity. This is not Trump 1. The Treasury, under the aegis of economic nationalism, seeks to drastically restructure global trade through punitive tariffs centered on a violent decoupling of US and Chinese economies. And the opposition to this doesn't come from the Democrats, it comes from Wall Street, the irrational stock markets upholding the last threshold of objective spirit. The Department of Justice and Homeland Security expand a legal exceptionalist nativism, defining new categories of internal enemy, experimenting with new forms of deportation, defying court orders, inciting against and arresting judges. The White House barks out absurd or illegal executive orders and asserts a general line of political advance, making a virtue of its abrupt reversals and contradictions. And James Carville recommends that the Democrats play dead, as if that needs to be made so explicit. The sum of these multiple conflagrations is a drive to constitutional rupture, similar to that achieved by the right in India and Hungary. In other words, we're not talking about the overthrow of parliamentary democracy. In none of these cases do you see anything like that attempted. Rather, a new kind of majoritarian legitimacy based upon the strengthening of the executive and the strengthening of majoritarian and ethno-nationalist restrictions in the legal system. However, beneath the shared missionary discipline, rifts and contradictions gape. The rivalry between Musk, Vance, and Besant exploded, as you know, into an open breach with Trump. On trade, power shifts between the pro-Wall Street Treasury Secretary Scott Besant and the moronic Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. And these fissures correspond to real contradictions, because you can fight inflation or you can have a chaotic economic uncoupling with China. You can onshore manufacturing if you want, or you can raise input costs without creating the necessary capacity, all the while indulging a tech libertarian assault on the administrative state's counter-cyclical capacities. You can have foreign policy realism, as Vance and Rubio brag about, and a Gaza ceasefire as a platform for expanded normalization talks in the Middle East. Or you can let Netanyahu resume the genocide at pace, go full neocon, and join it in an exploratory war with Iran. Still, even with all these contradictions, the rightist rupture is real and very threatening. Incipient fascism, before accumulating historical force through multiple conflagrations, first feasts on a decomposing liberalism. The only thing that could stop this spiral is a counteroffensive creating multiple dilemmas on diverse fronts, overwhelming the regime's capacity to steer itself, let alone persist with its offensive. And just to finish on this, we need ruptures of our own, otherwise even the defense won't work. And because apart from the curdled resentment and the desire for revenge that I'm saying is abroad, there is another and more original striving, one that is muted in the shattered anomic existences of late capitalism, one that's expressed in fugitive desires for a vaguely better society that erupt from time to time in little ruptures and in fights, one that has indeed found various perverse and destructive outcomes in some of the terrorist regimes of the 20th century, and yet persists and is present in every decent accomplishment of the human race from abolition to democracy. And that is the hunger that lurks even in the shriveled soul of the academic pedant, no offense to any of you, the appetite that even bourgeois politicians try to milk and triangulate when they waffle about joy and hope, the appetite that forms in every human soul, a little Marx and a little Kropotkin, and we could call it a striving toward the good, the true, and the beautiful, but I'm just going to go ahead and call it communism. I think I'll end it there. Thank you.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit sort of on the disaster nationalism theme and more also like along the lines of your other book, The Twittering Machine. So if you could talk about that stuff a little bit more explicitly, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Tell me how we got here that Trump can be, you know, selected and gain that many votes.
How do we build more powerful structures that can win? And more importantly, how do we rebuild on the left the desire to win?
Okay, I'm going to take them in order. So the first question was about relating it back to what I'd written previously about the social industry and social media and the Twittering machine, and the question of how social media can be used to whip up moral panics or develop common sense narratives that benefit the right. I would say that what's important is how the right is much better at using these technologies than the left, not because we're like incompetent or anything, but rather because these platforms are designed to be better used by top-down, centralized, and well-funded operations. They were designed essentially for corporations, PR organizations, celebrities, and what have you, not for your average user. And certainly we bought into, or some parts of the left bought into, the idea that they're very horizontal types of communication systems. They're really not. So then the question is, what does the far right do and how do they organize on it? And you can see a consistent pattern of building up rhythms of outrage over specific subjects using troll farms. In the Philippines, one of the things that Rodrigo Duterte did before he won in 2016, was his organizers ran a bunch of like local Facebook pages and things like that, which were ostensibly non-political, just devoted to local subjects. And what they did was, as the election was approaching, they began a rhythm of posting regularly about crime, because this was his big issue, crime, and drugs particularly. And as the election got closer and closer, they intensified the rhythm. And they started posting more and more violently about the need to crack down on criminals and drug dealers and drug addicts. And it's not that the number of people who are looking at these pages by themselves is sufficient, but rather that it creates currents that starts to get attention on national media. It starts to get picked up, and you can game a kind of bubble, because then that creates a kind of circular reinforcement effect where media coverage encourages more people to start posting about this stuff. And then it starts to appear in the polls. In Brazil, Bolsonaro had what was called an office of hate. And the idea very overtly of far-right trolls in Brazil, it's not to disprove somebody's ideas. They're not fighting a battle of ideas. It's to damage somebody's career, or to cause them to undergo physical danger. It's a politics of destruction and humiliation of the enemy. This is a technique of cyber war. I'd be very surprised if there weren't similar techniques being used by the Republican right, by the Trump guys and all the rest of it. It's a global phenomenon. So it's how do we get from individuals being ready for some kind of revenge, resentful, feeling belittled, feeling powerless, and wanting to take it out on somebody and wanting a sense of direction for their aggression, to that being channeled into tactics of, for example, orchestrating waves of harassment, and sexual harassment, rape threats, death threats against journalists, opposition, and so on. It's the combination between the networked type of organization that people use on the social industry platforms and the top-down centralized forms of orchestration that are used by, say, the Putin regime, the Brazilian government under Bolsonaro, and so on. So I think that's roughly the line that I would take on that. The second questioner asked a question about Trump. How did we get here? Because ultimately, yes, of course, Trump had support from billionaires and he had money and all the rest of it. And the question is, how were there so many people susceptible to this sort of stuff? I would say there's two crucial points. One is, yes, of course, everything that I've said about resentment and the need for revenge and all the rest of it. But the other side of that is the disorganization of the left. Like historical defeats on the left, meaning we were in recession for about 30 years. Our victories have been infrequent, briefly held, quickly reversed. And when we have started to have some wins recently, it's often been from a point of view of immaturity, lack of organizational development, lack of experience. And so we were not well placed to organize the alternative. And I guess then the question would be, what happens when the transition is thwarted, it's blocked? And this is something that some German comrades have been working on in the context of, for example, the inability of German democracy to manage the climate transition, despite that being a big major goal of the last government on pro-capitalist terms. But they weren't able to do it because of the ingrained constitutional commitment to what they call Black Zero, having no debt in the state. So what happened instead, rather than having that sort of rational capitalist modernization, was militarization. They realized they could do it through militarization. They could spend 100 billion euro on building roads and infrastructure, and they could call it military Keynesianism. What I'm saying is that what a lot of these far-right organizations and parties have done is offer a version of the transition, not climate transition per se, but industrial modernization, dealing with some of the contradictions in the system, the growing pathologies, and so on. And they have offered aspects of a solution. You know, remember Trump was talking about massive investments in 2016, never delivered it. But there was an idea there, he was ripping it off from the left, of course, the idea of, you know, using the state to invest in the economy to ostensibly benefit working people, but in his case it would have been to the benefit of oligopolies, people close to the state, crony capitalists, and what have you. In other words, this thrives on not just the decay of liberalism, as I said before, but also the weakness of the left.
You're listening to Richard Seymour on Resent.